This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Since 1997, the ECHO Foundation, co-founded by Elie Wiesel and Charlotte Stephanie Ansaldo, has been honoring world-renowned humanitarians and bringing them to our city as a way of encouraging young people and others to follow in their footsteps to demonstrate the incredible impact one person can have in the world, the power of one person to create positive change. This year, the ECHO Foundation is bringing together two Nobel laureates in chemistry while also recognizing Panthers owner Jerry Richardson for his business and civic contributions, as well as his often anonymous behind-the-scenes efforts to help others find justice and hope. And the organization is also launching a new Science for Humankind curriculum based on the belief that science can bring us together and create a better future. So this hour, we meet one of the Nobel Prize winners being honored here in Charlotte. Actually, that took place last night, and we're very pleased that he took the time to be with us this morning. Dr. Martin Chalfie is the William R. Keenan Jr. Professor of Biology at Columbia University, who won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 2008. I suppose that is a story in itself, but so is Dr. Chalfie's success in his chosen field, which he describes as unexpected and a combination of factors, including chance, luck, the influence of others, and in some cases, his own pig-headedness. Those are his words, by the way. And Dr. Chalfie joins us for the hour. Welcome to Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Now, I know the answers to many of the questions I'm going to ask today, because when you win the Nobel Prize, the Nobel Committee asks you to write a bio. And your bio, which you supplied, is unlike any I have ever read. It was wonderful reading.
Thank
truly.
You.
And it's all about you and your personal life and growing up. And you would think, who aside from your immediate family would care? But it's incredibly well written, very entertaining, and very enlightening, and you've called your journey to the Nobel Prize unexpected. I think I know why, but you tell me why.
Well, so my journey in science had a few bumps along the way.
I'd say.
I was always interested in nature and science and learned the planets early. I was interested in dinosaurs, much like most kids or many kids are interested in. And so when I went to college, I decided, well, I should do something in science. I should major in a science. At first, I actually wanted to be a math major, and that quickly got out of my skill range. So I decided I was going to major in biochemistry. And I knew that one of the things you were supposed to do when you started working as a scientist was to get some experience, to go into a lab and do some work. And so I arranged with one of the professors to work over the summer. But he didn't have any room in his lab, and so I was placed about 50 yards away from him in a student lab with no one else around. And I was given a project, and I read about the project, and I set up the experiments, and nothing worked. Not just the first time. Every time I tried the experiment over the entire summer, it failed completely.
And you weren't trying to duplicate somebody else's work. This was new work.
This was new work.
Okay.
But I also had a very misguided idea. And the misguided idea was that if you were really destined to be a scientist or destined to be really anything, you had to have it innately in you. There was nothing about working at it, finding out things, asking questions. It was had to be in you. And if you didn't have it in you, that was it. You should give up. Mm-hmm. And so that meant I didn't ask a lot of questions, which is probably the reason everything failed that I tried to do. Anyway, I got to the end of the summer, and I went and talked to the guy I was working for, and he said, look, there's a couple more weeks left in the term. Why don't you go home, relax, and before the semester starts, come back, all rested, and do the experiment one more time. Give it one more chance. Now, if it doesn't work, we're going to have to just forget about the project, but try it one more time. And I went home, had a wonderful time, rested, came back, and it didn't work. And I decided that's the end of it for me. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be a scientist. And so I completely, you know, I finished up the last course I needed for my biochemistry major, and it was my senior year. And I was able to take all these wonderful courses. I took one course in Dostoevsky, one course in 20th century drama, one course in constitutional law. I just sampled everything. Wow. And I had a wonderful year learning a lot. Now, I've actually told this story before, and one person wrote this up, but I just said, and said that in his senior year, Marty Chalfie took courses in drama, law, and Russian literature. And another reporter reading this wrote, this was in Milan, Italy, he was writing up something, and he looked at this, and he wrote, he didn't write what even that person said, he translated it, misunderstanding courses for corso, meaning a course of study. And he said that after I had decided not to be a scientist, I had become a lawyer, an actor, and an authority on Russian literature. So I became an instant Renaissance man. In any case, after a couple of years of a bunch of odd jobs, I went to I got a job as a high school teacher.
Yeah.
And high school teachers, students have the summer off to have vacation. High school students have to, high school teachers have to find a job. So I looked around, and a friend of mine, we were near New Haven, Connecticut, so a friend of mine said that she had a friend at Yale that might hire me. And I went, and I was hired by this man. I think because I remembered a paper I had written as an undergraduate and related in a very tangential way with this man's research, which I was fascinated about. It was very interesting because it was asking a biological question that I had no idea about. I had never thought of before. Mm. And that is that we have some parts of our body that are transparent. Don't usually think about that, that we have parts of our body that are transparent. But, of course, the cornea and lens in our eye is transparent. And he was working on how are they transparent. And part of it was the flow of ions through the channel. There was an active transport. And this triggered a memory of a paper I had written when I was an undergraduate. And I asked him a question. I asked him if a small molecule that was a signaling molecule worked in this system. And he looked at me all surprised and said, you know, you're the second person in 2 days to ask me this question. Hmm. I don't know what the answer is. So I think because I asked him a question, he hired me. So that was the first miracle. The second miracle was 1 week after I started, and he had, by the way, given me an exceptionally boring problem to work on over the summer. The second miracle occurred. He walked into the lab, and he said, goodbye. I'm going to Europe to do my own research. I'll see you at the end of the summer. So it was not quite like the first time when I was left alone, because this time I wasn't left alone. There was a postdoc in the lab who could help me with the experiments, and I asked him lots of questions about how to set things up. And I found the second person that had asked the question, who was a postdoctoral fellow in another lab. And I went to this man and I said, if I were going to test this idea, how would I do it? And he said, I would throw on adrenaline, and that should stimulate it. And so I went back to the lab, and I set up the experiment, and I threw the drug on. I threw adrenaline on, and it just went off scale. It worked beautifully.
Wow.
And I spent the entire summer working on my project, and I never worked on on what I was assigned to do, which was maybe a mistake. But anyway, that's what I did. I also went to the library, and I read things. And when the boss came back at the end of the summer, he said, okay, well, what happened with that experiment? And I said, I didn't do it. I was a little surprised, I would imagine. And I said, however, this is what I have. This is what I'd spent the summer on, and I have all these results. And fortunately for me, he liked that very much. He actually went in the lab and did one additional experiment, and that became my first published paper. And the whole idea of being able to come up with an idea and to get an experiment to work gave me a lot more confidence that I could do it. And also, by that time, I had realized, you know, a lot of times in science, things fail. And so that it worked a little bit, and that's when I applied
the grad. You also realized something else, because at the very beginning of the story, you talked about how you thought that if it was not innately in you, then you didn't have the stuff, therefore you should get out of science. What you discovered was collaboration.
Exactly.
Talking to people, asking questions, working with someone else, and using that information as a way to move along the trail toward the ultimate goal. Why do you think that was a surprise to you?
Because I think, you know, I graduated from college in 1969, and I think there was a general attitude that everyone worked alone. I mean, I often talk about this in my seminars where I say that when we hear stories in the past of the great scientists, yeah. Einstein, Newton, Copernicus, Darwin, we don't hear about them working with other people. As I like to joke, scientists always seem to work alone, but they might have an assistant named Igor. But, you know, that's the attitude, that there was the great, in fact, in almost all of these, except for Marie Curie at the time that I was learning about science, they're all white men that are doing this, and they're all loners. It's Fleming discovering penicillin. Everyone is a individual, and it's the individual genius. It gives the wrong impression of science, and it clearly is a sort of mindset. I can do this on my own. I try now with my students, especially in the courses that I teach, to say to them, I don't want you to learn this on your own. I want you to do this as a collaboration.
And this is what one of the things that you didn't like about being a high school teacher, because high school teachers talk all day. So when they get together amongst themselves, they're quiet. But scientists work in the lab, and they're concentrated on whatever it is they're engaged in. And when they take a break, you can't shut them up.
Certainly, you can't shut me up. That's one of the problems. But in fact, most of my ideas come from reading. Mm-hmm. That's certainly clear. But a lot of my ideas come from interacting with people in my lab. When they write a paper and we discuss what is in the paper, it often changes drastically. If we're talking out an experiment, other ideas come simply from the interactions and the talking. So for me, it's extremely important.
You also said that people have this image of scientists as being solitary people, perhaps with an assistant named Igor. And that is part of the problem that science faces today. And we've done programs on this, that people, lay people who don't know anything about science, get everything they know about science from movies, which are generally the mad scientist with Igor in the background. That's not how it works. And if people...
Hardly any of us are mad.
Angry, perhaps.
Yes.
But if people knew what went on in the lab and how it was being conducted, would we be in a better position today?
Well, I would hope so. I think every lab is individual. When I was a graduate student, because I was really a novice, I was really assigned a project to work on. And I worked very closely with my advisor. Mm-hmm. When I was a postdoc, it was a completely different thing. I had a postdoctoral advisor, Dr. Sidney Brenner, who himself won the Nobel Prize in 2002. And Sidney ran a very different operation, because he figured you were there, you knew what you wanted to do, and he left you alone. I was there 5 years. I talked to him 5 times in the 5 years.
Wow. Dr. Martin Chalfie, a Nobel Prize winner for chemistry in 2008, our guest this hour. So much to talk about, not enough time. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Cleveland County Arts Council, hosting the 12th Annual Art of Sound Music Festival, September 18th through the 20th in Uptown Shelby, North Carolina, artofsoundcc.org. And Cabbage, supporting small businesses with a line of credit up to $100,000. Online application, 24/7 access, over $400 million extended to businesses from restaurants to advertising agencies at Cabbage, with a K, cabbage.com. Well, the war in Afghanistan will go down as the longest in American history and as one more so-called dirty war in this country's 200-year history of fighting such conflicts. Dirty wars are everything regular warfare is not. They're especially bloody, polarizing, poorly understood. But Davidson-College's Dr. Russell Crandall has made it his business to understand them and to suggest ways of fighting them in a different way, and he will explain it all tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, President Obama outlines plans to combat ISIS at a time confidence in his foreign policy is at an all-time low. Some say his next steps will define his presidency. Obama's address to the nation and the challenges facing his administration.
That's the Diane Rehm Show, coming up next from 10 to noon on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Dr. Martin Chalfie, the winner of the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 2008 and a professor of biology at Columbia University. He's here under the auspices of the ECHO Foundation. They had their annual awards last night here at the McGlone Theater at Spirit Square. And today he'll be speaking with Dr. Eric Raghavan, a frequent guest on our program from Carolina's Medical Center and the Levine Cancer Institute, in a closed session. But nonetheless, Dr. Chalfie has been exposed to 600 students, high school students and college students, and now professionals. And we're going to wear you out before you leave, Charlotte. I can promise you that. Your story is really interesting, and I think it is one that might inspire or give hope to young people who maybe have dabbled in the idea that science is interesting for whatever reason. Maybe it's because of the iPad they're holding in their hand and they realize a scientist invented it. Many scientists invented it. But maybe they feel that they have no aptitude for it, or they don't know how to get from where they are today to where you are right now. Well, you had no – your roadmap was all over the place, as you just said. You come from immigrant grandparents. Your paternal grandmother ended up as a cook in the executive dining room of the Manischewitz Company, the winemaker. Your father taught himself to play guitar, banjo, mandolin, became a staff guitarist at one – this is back in the 40s, I guess.
30s.
At one of the biggest radio stations in the country back then, WLW in Cincinnati, still a great station today, and later played with the Russ Morgan Orchestra. Now, many people don't know who that is, but they were big in their time. And what about your mother and your mother's side of the
story? So my mother actually, my grandmother on my mother's side in 1933 started her own business. It was a dress manufacturing business.
That's extraordinary.
It was, and she was an extraordinary person and it was very influential.
Mountain Home, wasn't it?
It's called Mountain Home, and the reason it was called Mountain Home, and this was a dress manufacturing company in downtown Chicago, mm-hmm. So the furthest you could get from the mountains. But previously, her husband, who had done various, was called a jobber. They, sort of a textile worker for hire, mm-hmm. had an order for a lot of sweaters, and the label said Mountain Home, and somehow that deal went through, and they had lots of extra labels, and it was 1933 and the Depression, and so you don't throw that stuff out, you just name the companies differently, and you go from there. So my grandmother started this in 1933, and my mother, and it must have been only about a year or so after that, was an undergraduate at the University of Chicago, but because of the Depression, she and her family could not pay the $100 tuition.
Yeah, I mean,
semester. And instead of asking, is there any fellowships or scholarships, what I think probably didn't cross her mind in any way, when she went down to breakfast, her parents said, we don't have the money to pay for the tuition. She went back upstairs, changed her clothes, and from that day on worked with my grandmother. And that was
in the clothing business.
In the clothing business.
And you.
Then when my father married my mother after World War II, he didn't want to remain a professional guitarist because of all the traveling that was going to be involved.
Right.
And so he eventually joined with my mother in the company.
Your father taught you to play guitar, and you said that you really envied his teaching skills, that you wish you had those teaching skills. Did he teach you well? Can you still play?
I still play. I'm not sure I play all that well, but I I've enjoyed it. So I was given a guitar when I was 12 years old. I was the oldest of his three sons, and so I was the one that got the guitar, and I'm lucky for that. And he didn't want me to learn popular guitar. He wanted me to learn classical guitar. And at the time, which is about 1959, there were two well-known classical guitar, if anyone cared about this at the time. And at that time, everyone just knew about Segovia and probably nothing else. But there were two classical guitar teachers in the United States. One was Sophocles Pappus in Washington, D.C., and the other was a man named Richard Pick in Chicago. And Richard Pick had written several books of instruction. And my father called him up and said that he'd like his son to take lessons from Richard. And Richard said, well, you know, and my father said, do you take children? I was 12. Pick said, I'm sorry, I don't take young children. And my father said, well, look, if I use your beginner book and he can get through the entire book with me teaching him, will you then take him? And so for the first year, my father taught me all the pieces in Richard Pick's first book. And I learned them, and almost all of them were duets, and they were, so it was lots of fun to sort of play these with him.
Yeah.
And he really, what I meant by his teaching style is he never said, oh, no, that's not the way to do it. Do it like this, or sort of jump in when I was messing things up and try to correct me. He just said, well, okay, keep going and keep doing it. You know, I remember crying at first because I couldn't tune the guitar worth anything. And he just, you know, we just went through it, and eventually I got these things. At the end of the year, after I had finished the book, my father called Pick up again and said, okay, my son has gone through the books. Remember our deal, you were going to take him. And Pick said, sure, I'll teach him. By the way, how old is your son? My father said, well, he's 13 now. And Pick said, when I said I wouldn't take young children, I meant children of 4 and 5. So it's a different definition of what a young child was, my father's view and Richard Pick's view.
So given how your father approached teaching you, how do you think that has informed you as a teacher, but also as a scientist, as somebody who has to learn through experimentation?
Well, it's certainly something I emulate, but I have to say I have a daughter who's now 22, and sometimes I can't keep my mouth shut about advice, so I'm not entirely...
So it didn't take...
I haven't really taken the lesson from my youth really to heart. I think it's a little bit difficult.
So your mom was in the clothing business, and your father eventually got involved in it, and he was kind of like a... He wasn't a salesperson, because evidently this clothing line was so popular with the people who sold it in the stores that sold this clothing line. They didn't need to be sold. He was just kind of an order taker. And in
well, it was more than that. In 1970, after I had graduated from college, one of those short jobs that I did was to do my father's job for a month because he was recovering from surgery from colon cancer, which he had survived. And I went on the road, and here is somebody who knows nothing. I couldn't describe the dress or what thing. I had a list of what colors things came in, but I didn't know anything. And I had discovered that my father had a very interesting sales technique, because what he would go on a 5,000-mile journey from Chicago basically through New England. So basically going east, going through New England, down to Maryland, and then back up again. And every city that he went to, there would be one store. The city could be New York City. Mm-hmm. There was one store. Boston, one store. Small towns, one store. He didn't try to make any rivalry, and he wanted to have these as customers forever. So there was no hard sell, because if you tried to put over something on someone, they wouldn't appreciate you.
Right.
So he never did that. He would tell them what it was. And so it was easy for me to do this job, in a sense, because I didn't have to know anything. It was quite good. I would go into the store, I'd open up the sample rack, and most of these stores, because these are rather expensive outfits, usually for professional women or women at the time, this was 1970, a lot of time these were for wives of successful business people, and these stores were unusual because the buyers knew who they wanted the dresses for. Oh, Mrs. Jones will like that. Mrs. Schwartz will like this one. And they would pick out the dresses, not because they liked them, but because they knew they were going to instantaneously sell them, because they would call up the people and say, well, the latest Mountain Home dress is here. And so they would go in and pick out all these dresses that they want. The dresses would come into the shops, and before the customers that they wanted to sell them to came in, they would display them. And so other people would see them and say, you know, I like that. Does that come in green or does that come in blue? And then they'd order the outfits as reorders. So there was this first initial attempt to get them to see what it was. So I would just go in and simply show them. But after about the second or third time, some of the people that were doing the buying would ask, what's popular? And I could say, well, I'm not really sure, but in the last two places, here are the two or three things that people liked. And they said, you know, you're right. That we like those too. And they would order them. And there was one particular dress, dress number 202. And I said, well, the last place ordered a bunch. We'll order a bunch of these too. I go through the entire route. By the time I finished, my parents told me I had sold more of 202 than they had ever sold of anything else. It was a very nice outfit. People liked it. I had nothing to do with it. And there was one store that my father, Providence, Rhode Island, my father had not been able to establish a store there. And there was a man who he had contacted, and he was going to see him, but then because of this, I was going to see this man. And I go into them, the guy opened up the rack, and he looks at it and asks me, you know, what did people like? And he later told my father, a couple years later, that he realized I was a complete incompetent and didn't know anything about what I was doing, and he felt sorry for me. So he bought three dresses, one of which was 202. And when he displayed it, later, it kept selling and selling and selling. And he said, it was the nicest thing I ever did was to take pity on this guy. So that's the story of the...
And that was in 1970. That's pretty late in your life in terms of being a young adult, because you were out of college.
I was just out of college. Yes.
Your mother at one point told you that despite everything else about you, she thought she knew that you would ultimately go to Harvard. And, of course, you did. You also excelled, I read, in chemistry in high school, and you took a special advanced placement class with only 11 students in the class. And your teacher, when we talk a lot about teachers on this program and how they're being hamstrung, your teacher was able to do something in that class that teachers today are probably not allowed to do. I want you to talk about that and talk about the two-hour break the break in a two-hour exam.
So this was Mr. Sturgis. He was we had exchange students, but he was an exchange teacher. He came from England, and he taught this class, and it was an intense, advanced chemistry class, and we just loved it, and we had a lot of fun. And then in the middle of the two-hour period, he would have a break for about five or so minutes, and we would make up songs, and we would tell jokes, and we had actually a very wonderful time. I think we learned an enormous amount that time. One, because he was just a nice person. And he let us sort of go. And I remember once we had a substitute teacher, and it took us a long time to explain to this teacher that we were supposed to have this break. And we had sung to some degree the 1812 overture in class and stuff.
All
and she didn't really appreciate that at all. Including the canon.
Yeah,
yes.
And you sang your version of the Disney song, Just a Spoonful of Sugar.
Yes, so C12 H22O11 helps the medicine go down.
It doesn't scan very well. But
no. But we were able to sing it because none of us had any voices anyway. We were all basically tone deaf.
So your road to science, not just to the Nobel Prize, but your road to science was kind of interesting because you although you excelled in chemistry, you went to Harvard, you weren't sure what your major was going to be. As a result of that, you lost out on a scholarship in science. You turned to biochemistry. You decided to pursue social sciences. Didn't go well. You dropped out. You picked up some odd jobs, taught high school for a while. This, I guess, is why you say your road to the Nobel was due to chance and luck and the influence of others and your own pig-headedness. Who might have been your influences, your positive influences that led to the Nobel Prize? Who were the influences?
So there were a number of people that were influential. One who just died recently was a Harvard professor named Woody Hastings. And he was just a wonderful person. I remember taking a course. It actually was the course where I wrote that paper that mm-hmm. ultimately helped me. And he was one of the giants of studying bioluminescence. And when I went to him to take his course, because I was on the swimming team, I couldn't go to the library in the afternoon to read the papers he assigned. And so I went to him and I said, "I'm sorry, I can't go to the library in the afternoon. Is there any possibility that you could arrange that I have a key?" And he said, "Oh, of course you should get a key to the library so I could go in the evening." And instead of just writing a note or anything, this man, who had his office on the fourth floor of the bio labs, gets out from behind his desk. He says, "Come with me." And he walks down with me four flights of stairs. We walk into a secretary's office, and he points to the secretary, points to me, and says, "This guy needs a key. Can you please give it to him?" And the idea that someone would walk four flights of stairs and do something for me, who I didn't think, I was just another one of the students, I thought was astonishing. And over the years, we maintained our friendship. So it was the kindness. It wasn't the science. It was the kindness. Yeah. My PhD, Jose Zadonaisky, who I did that summer stint with at Yale, was very kind about writing letters of recommendation and everything. My PhD advisor, Bob Perlman, was a wonderful man. And I had a desk right outside his office. And every time I had an idea, good or bad or anything, I felt perfectly free to go and talk with him and ask him about the idea. And at the beginning, a lot of times he said, "That's a wonderful idea. I just read a paper where they did that." And I'd get all depressed. And he'd say, no, that means you have the right ideas. That's good. You just get more of them." And so, again, we've stayed friends for a long time.
And you talk about your pig-headedness. Now, and you talked about earlier in this conversation, you talked about one professor assigning you a summer series of experiments, and you didn't do them, you did your own, because that's what you wanted to do. Aside from that, what other aspects of you are pig-headed?
Well, I think the work that earned me the Nobel Prize is a good example of this. Where I say that it was accidents and everything. So quickly, a very brief thing about how this all started. So this all has to do with a protein from a jellyfish. The protein is called the green fluorescent protein. And it's called that because, like any fluorescent material, it absorbs light of one color, blue, and gives off green.
Let me stop you there because we're going into a break, and this is actually what won you the Nobel Prize, so let's not give it short shrift. We'll take a break. We'll come back and find out more about that. Dr. Martin Chalfie, our guest, the winner of the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 2008. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Opera Carolina presenting Art, Poetry, Music, a gala benefit concert at the Knight Theater on Saturday. For more info, 704-372-1000 or operacarolina.com. And Cat Wealth Consulting, LLC. Martha Cat is a financial advisor specializing in retirement planning for State of North Carolina employees. Online at cattwealth.com. President Obama outlines plans to combat ISIS at a time when confidence in his foreign policy is at an all-time low. Some say his next steps will define his presidency. his address to the nation and the challenges facing his administration, the topic of the conversation, 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join our conversation, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
Allentown, Pennsylvania got a reputation from the 80s Billy Joel song. But now, the town wants to change its tune.
Allentown deserved a different place than that song ever put us in.
I'm David Gura. Allentown is our next stop on American Futures with Jim Fallows of The Atlantic. That's next time on Marketplace from APM.
Join Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, along with Dr. Martin Chalfie, the William Keenan Jr. Professor of Biology at Columbia University and winner of the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 2008. He's here under the auspices of the ECHO Foundation, which every year honors people for their humanitarian work and also for people who make a difference, one person making a difference in the world. And I guess a Nobel Prize winner just might qualify for that. You were talking about the work that won you the Nobel Prize on bioluminescence, and it comes from this particle, this protein. Comes from a protein, comes from a jellyfish.
Yes. Okay. And the work that started all this out and was one of the person who did this was one of the co-winners with me in 2008, Osamu Shimomura. Mm-hmm. An unbelievably interesting individual, also a different trajectory.
Did you work together in the lab or in different countries?
The work he did was in 1962, and I didn't hear about it until 1989, and then our work was in 1992. So that was 30 years after he did his work.
So you built on his work?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. I was working on, as I do now, I'm a geneticist and I work on the development and the function of nerve cells, particularly the function of certain nerve cells that sense touch, trying to understand the molecular basis of the senses.
And you do this with worms, don't you?
I do it with a very small worm called Cenorhabditis elegans, which is, as an adult, is only a 25th of an inch long, and we look at it under the microscope all the time. And it has one wonderful property. It's transparent. So we can put it under the microscope and see all the cells, or at least all the nuclei of the cells. And it only has 959 cells in it, and we know every single one of these cells. And so this is an animal that we can do a lot of genetics, and we were looking at the genetics of touch. We were finding mutants that were insensitive to touch, and we wanted to know, as we cloned the genes.
Meaning, if they were insensitive to touch, meaning that they couldn't sense it at all? They didn't know they were being touched?
That's right.
Okay, all right.
We knew what cells were the sensing cells.
Okay.
But we didn't know how it worked, how they worked. What were the molecules that allowed the cells to sense? I should add, we have no idea about the sense of touch, really, in humans at all. In fact, in general, we've known for like 130 years that there's a molecule in our retinas, in our eyes, that allow us to see, to detect light. It's called rhodopsin. It was easy to isolate. In the last 30 years, we've learned about the molecules that detect signals if they're chemical signals. But we have a lot of mechanically driven cells. Cells like the hair cells in our ears that allow us to hear, or the hair cells also in the inner ear that allow us to detect acceleration and help our balance. We have stretch receptors in our muscles, and we have something like five different cells in our skin that detect different types of touch. We have detectors of blood pressure. All of these are mechanically driven, and all of them are characterized by the fact that we don't know how they work at all. We know the cells, we just don't know what the molecules are. And so we thought, by looking for worms that were touch insensitive, getting these mutant animals and then cloning the genes, we'd be able to get some insight into this problem. And so that's what we were working on in 1989 when I heard the story about Osamu Shimomura. Worked on a transparent animal, we were cloning genes, and we wanted to know where were the genes turned on, which cells activated the genes. And there were methods to do this, but they were rather cumbersome methods. They answered the question. But in order to do the experiments, we had to prepare the
specimens. You had to take the animals. Basically, you killed them, fixed them so nothing moved around, and then permeabilize them, poke holes in them so all the reagents could get in to detect the active genes. And this could be done, but it gave you a static view of life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I go to a seminar in 1989, and the seminar speaker starts talking about Shimamura's work back in 1962 on the jellyfish. And his experiments are sort of interesting. I mean, his whole life is interesting, and I urge your viewers to go to the NobelPrize.org website and either read or listen to his 29-minute speech of acceptance for the Nobel. At the age of 16, he's told, you have to quit high school. That's it. You're going to work in a paint factory. And he goes, leaves the city he was born in to go over the adjacent mountains into the next valley and start working in a paint factory. That turned out actually to be good for him because the city was Nagasaki, Japan, and it was 1945. And by being on the other side of the mountains, he was protected when the city was destroyed by the atomic bomb. He then went in, couldn't go to college because there was no college.
Mm-hmm.
After a couple of years, was able to go to the first part of the college that he could be part of, which was the pharmacy school. Mm. He goes through pharmacy school, gets a job as a technician in a lab, and that starts his lifelong love of trying to understand how different organisms generate light. What's the biochemistry behind this? Now, we know about fireflies, but there are many other organisms that make light. In addition to fireflies, there's glowworms, there are fungi, there are bacteria, there are crustaceans and jellyfish and all sorts of organisms that generate light. And so he was interested in that problem. And in 1962, he had come to the United States, having been given a PhD for some previous work he had done, and he started working on this jellyfish. And this is where accident comes in, because he's a very good biochemist, and he's isolating everything, and nothing works. It's just like my time.
Yeah.
So it's over and over and over again. And then towards the end of the summer when he's working, he's worked late at night. He can't, you know, it has failed again. He takes the prep and he throws it in the sink. He's cleaning up. He throws it in the sink. There's some seawater and some jellyfish parts, some other things in the sink. Turns off the light because it's late at night. And he's just about to walk out the door. He looks back at the sink. And it's glowing. He's a little surprised at that. So that's the scientific method. You throw it on the floor, you throw it in the sink. I should have known this when I was an undergraduate to be able to do that. And so he looks at this and he realizes there must have been something in the seawater that activated the production of light. And after a little bit of experimentation, he realizes it's calcium. So he discovers the protein that makes light for the jellyfish. That's his first accidental discovery. The second accidental discovery came from the fact that it was the wrong color light. The jellyfish produce a green light. This protein produced a blue light.
Mm.
So he thought about that for a little while and said, there must be something else. And by shining a light onto the various samples that he found a different sample that whenever he would irradiate it with blue light, he would get green light out. And so he wrote this up in his 1962 paper as footnote number 3. And I said, I found this other protein, and I'm calling it the green protein. We now call this the green fluorescent protein. And I believe this is the only time that a footnote won its author a Nobel Prize. And I'm listening to this. This guy described this in a seminar. I said, I work on a transparent animal. I want to know where the gene is expressed. I can attach this thing, and all I have to do in a living animal is shine blue light through the transparent animal, and I'll see wherever this protein is because it'll be green. And I never paid any more attention to the talk I was listening to. After we started doing the work, when I learned about the literature, and this is where the pig-headedness comes in, I found that everybody in the field believed that this protein on its own would not be fluorescent, that it needed, there was a special rearrangement of the molecule, and everyone thought it required another protein to make that rearrangement. And so it couldn't work on its own if you just added it to something. It wouldn't work. You'd have to add both. And who knew if it required one converting process or two or three or more. So it might require a lot of things. And everyone believed it's just this is not an experiment that's going to work. And so that's where the pigheadedness comes in. You don't listen to those people. You try the experiment. And we did. And it worked the first time. It was wonderful.
If I understand this correctly, you were working on this worm before you started working on the bioluminescence.
This is what I started as my postdoc.
And you still are working with this organism.
That's right.
Today, how many years would you say you have devoted yourself, your professional life, to this little creature?
Oh, I can tell you exactly. It's about 37.
37 years.
Yes.
When you started, were your goals the same as they are today, or have you achieved certain goals and now you've moved on to other discoveries or trying to discover other things?
We had certain goals at the beginning. We met those goals, but the goals always change. You're always looking for new things. Also, there's a wonderful thing in the book, The Eighth Day of Creation, which is about the beginning of molecular biology by Horace Freeland Judson. He talks about an interview with Alfred Hershey, who was one of the people, he got a Nobel with Martha Chase for actually showing that DNA was the genetic material.
Mm-hmm.
Someone asks Alfred Hershey, what is your idea of scientific heaven? And he says, well, it's doing the same experiment over and over again, and it always works. But what he really means by that is that not only it always works, but you learn something new and exciting every time you do it. And this worm, with the particular nerve cells that we study, is as close to Hershey heaven as I'm ever going to get. So there's always new questions about nerve cell development, about the modulation. We figured out the sensor for touch. Now we're looking at how it's modified, how other things influence, what's the circuit involved, how are the connections between nerve cells made, how are the nerve cells interacting with the tissues around them. All of these questions are new, and they lead us into many other directions.
I mean, ultimately, if you discover everything you want to discover about this, and maybe this is a never-ending quest by you and other scientists, but if as far down the road as you can project, ultimately, what will you have achieved?
In some senses, we've already achieved some of these goals. We, in looking at this simple organism and understanding the molecular mechanism that allowed it to sense touch, we've discovered many new proteins that have turned out to be widespread, that are found in humans, that are found all over, and that we've looked at when we, to give one example, several years ago, I got an email from a scientist in Germany who said, you know, I work on the kidney. I'm a kidney surgeon and biochemist, and I have a protein that I'm working on that looks very much like one of the ones you work on. And do you want to collaborate? And I said, of course, this would be wonderful. And together we found that this class of proteins, of which there are many in humans as well as in worms, turn out at least a subset of them to be a completely new type of cholesterol binding protein. And we wanted, and so that discovery led to that interaction. So we're doing that. We're right now in the modulation, seeing effects of insulin on the sense of touch. And one thing that happens to diabetes, and I at this point have no idea whether there's any connection with what's happening in the worms and what's happened to people, but often people go to their doctor and say, you know, I'm numb in my fingers and my toes. And then it's found out that they have acquired adult onset type 2 diabetes,
right,
that it's one of the first signs that happens. We have no idea what the connection is here, but it's intriguing to us.
Yeah.
So we are discovering, and this is the real importance of basic research. You make discoveries, and then once you have them, there's this ripple effect of what can be done afterwards with them, and that people looking at things now have a different perspective. So the accomplishment is I'm not out to answer questions about a human disease. But I hope that the work that I'm doing by giving us a better understanding of the general biology is going to give some insights that will be taken up by others, maybe even by myself, to work on in different areas.
I mean, a lot of implications. You've written about how a lot of science is accidental. Discoveries are accidental. How much of it is in being smart enough to answer, to ask the right questions?
I'm not sure it's smart enough. I think it's maybe fortunate enough that you understand that there's something different that's going on. Enrico Fermi, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, once said, if you do an experiment and it confirms your hypothesis, you've made a measurement. But if it doesn't confirm your hypothesis, then you've made a discovery. So it's those things that are different, but you've got to do a lot of experiments to find the ones that are unusual.
I read that you said that winning the Nobel Prize in 2008 for chemistry has given you an audience. People listen to you and ask you questions and ask you to speak, and that's why you're on this program today. But you say also that people don't generally listen to scientists. That's true.
Unfortunately, it is. I think that people do that. I think, and this has been said by others, no one comes up and says, oh, you're a novelist or you're a playwright. I didn't do well in English. I won't understand you.
Yeah.
But they will come up to me a lot and say, oh, I did poorly in science. I won't understand what you're doing. And I find that unfortunate.
Because what you're doing is far more important, and I don't mean to belittle novelists, but far more important and far more impactful than somebody who writes a novel.
I think it's just different.
You're working in reality with impact on the whole world, ultimately.
Well, I think I wouldn't put them down. I think it's just something different, but it's a feeling that I think all too many people have that they cannot understand something. And my goal is to try to make it that they can understand things.
And that's a whole other show, which I would love to have the opportunity to talk to you about, and that's kids and science, because kids are not engaged, and they should be, because their entire world, everything they deal with, is science. Dr. Martin Chalfie, the winner of the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 2008. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you, Mike.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a